So if I may just continue a little bit with regard to the feeling tones. I mean, the neutral feeling tone, as sort of the name implies, it's a bit hard to distinguish. Neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Doesn't quite stand out as much as pleasant or unpleasant. So the tendency is to be unclear about it, which then can lead to certain degrees of doubt, confusion, uncertainty. You know, what's neutral feeling tone? What is it? I don't know. I have my doubts. When I was working on these hindrances, I thought, it, you know, many times the Buddha kind of, there's a certain progression in his teachings about what's more important at the beginning, and then they get more and more less important. So I thought the five hindrances, the most important one is sensual desire. Second is aversion, then sleepiness, lethargy and drowsiness, and then restlessness. And doubt was, you know, it's just at the end of the line, you know, so no big deal. I could finish this chapter easily. I got a surprise. Took me 6 months as I got lost in doubt. Doubt about the doubt about the doubt. What's doubt anyway? In the Buddha's time, doubt was quite simple. Doubt is the first of the hindrances to be transcended at the first level of awakening. So in the Buddha's time, doubt was quite simple. It was just doubting the Buddha, basically. There are many different teachings around that time. And then people were very confused which teaching was right. And so it was basically doubting the Buddha, the Dhamma, his teaching, and the monastic order who were practicing his teachings. Were they practicing rightly? But nowadays, I think doubt has become much more complex. Like we have self-doubt. Maybe even self-doubt is more of a hindrance than doubting the Buddha. Like doubting yourself, like basically doubting whether you can do it. You know, there were some teachings in the Buddha's time where their philosophy was, you know, you can't do it yourself. You gotta either pray to God for help, or just be patient. And when your incarnations have exhausted themselves, then you're enlightened. You see, but the Buddha was a believer in cause and effect, putting forth energy. So one can do something to realize, you know, more effort we put into it, more understanding we bring into it, we can realize awakening in this lifetime. But there was a variety of these different teachings around, and one of the most important one to not doubt is the teaching on causality. Now, right, the Buddha emphasized right view. Right view is the first factor of the Eightfold Path, right? Yes, right view, right thought, or right aspiration. But there's various refinements of right view. I would say the simplest form is having right view in regard to causality, cause and effect. If you don't believe in that, you don't understand that or accept that, there's no use even starting, you know? Because, you know, any effort you think, well, any effort I do is a waste of time, but in Buddhist view, any effort will give some positive result. Even if the effort fails, you could learn from it. Well, this doesn't work. Try something else, you see. But I realize in this time there's lots of different kinds of doubt. And I would put probably very strong hindrances maybe for some people. Like, for example, one is fear. I thought fear would be the sixth hindrance, you see. But following the Pali Canon, I had to get it into five. So I put fear under doubt. Yeah, is that okay? My opinion is that you're frightened of what you don't know. And then aversion is a reaction to it. Fear is not very nice. So that's one of those cases where maybe your first awareness is of aversion, but the real source is fear. So anyway, I put fear under doubt. And if you don't, even if you just are aware of fear, you can acknowledge fear, already it loses some of its fearfulness. Not a complete black boogeyman anymore, it's just fear. And every sentient being has fear. So it's a common reaction. But we have different kinds of fear, you know, ego fear, for example. Not just afraid of loud noises, we're afraid of losing myself. Existential fear. But the doubt is, there's various forms of it. There's a skeptical doubt. You know, for example, if you doubt these instructions of meditation, we don't even start. We don't have any. We haven't even got the momentum to put these teachings into practice to find out. So we need a certain degree of, maybe you can say, trust. The Pali word satta is translated as faith. Faith is one of the five spiritual powers. I would translate it maybe more like trust. You need to have some trust. And for me, anyway, the Buddhist teachings were fairly logical. So my trust was reason-based. I know I am not a faith temperament. But my faith in the Buddhist, my trust in the Buddhist teaching based on reason, is they seem reasonable to me. And then we put them into practice and we get more confidence as we get results. But if we don't even have that, you know, let's just give it a try anyway. We don't even start, and then we can't prove it. Maybe that could be useful to have a challenge. I challenge you to prove the Buddha's teachings right or wrong. Then you got to put them into practice to find out if they're right or wrong. And I have the trust that you'll find they're useful. So anyway, doubt is one of the hindrances, and I know some people, they really suffer from doubt. Either self-doubt, you know, I can't do it, or I'm not up to it, or doubting the path of practice. And it does require a certain amount of continuity. You know, many times people want to get an answer very quickly, you know. So, I'll do it, you know, if I get a payoff soon. You know? Unfortunately, in spiritual practice, this is dealing with ourself. You know, had a very, you know, some very basic habits and tendencies, so it maybe takes a bit of practice. You have to put it into practice and be patient with it. And, you know, maybe it helps. It's also helpful to know a little bit about the Buddha's teaching in general, because the Buddha gave many different teachings to different people at different times. So maybe some of the teachings, you know, don't make much sense to us, but perhaps if he gives some teaching to somebody else we come across, maybe that makes more sense to us. So some knowledge can be helpful to deal with doubt. And I would also say, you know, like there is the emphasis. Nowadays we're quite fortunate that the Pali Canon, which is a record of the Buddha's teachings, is available in English, so we have access to it. And before, the access was mainly through people teaching. But, you know, each teacher has their own particular, you know, angle on things too. And maybe it appeals to, maybe it doesn't. So rather than limit it just to what you hear from people, in the Buddha's time, the only way to receive the teachings was verbally. It was an oral tradition. And so they didn't have books in the Buddha's time. So people had to just listen to the teachings, to the talks. However, fortunately, the Buddha and some of his disciples had psychic powers to read people's minds, so they knew what to teach. The person's ready for this now, you know. But nowadays, I don't think it's so. That's such a prominent psychic power. So you just have to put things out, and hopefully somebody picks it up. But having the access to the Pali Canon, each one of us can read it, and at least you have some, maybe you don't really understand it, but you have some basis anyway to compare it to. You know, so if you hear some teacher going on about some weird stuff, you say, hey, that's not in the Pali Canon. You got something to compare it to, you see. So I think it's helpful to have the ability to cross-reference here. And really, it's all about experience, personal experience. In general, you know, the teachings are, they are universal teachings available to anybody. And in the beginning stages, you know, we can learn the general principles, but then we need to apply it to our own experience. You know, it's greed, aversion, delusion, but we all have our own personal brands of it. Huh? I have my personal kind of greed I have to deal with, my own personal kind of aversion and delusion to deal with. And some people have more of one than the other. You see? So we need to actually apply it to our own experience. And then if I can get into two more hindrances, lethargy and drowsiness. Anybody have a problem with that? Okay, skip that one. It is a lack of energy of some kind. And so first of all, it's important to be able to investigate it. I'd mention two kinds of energy, for example, how to deal with lethargy and drowsiness. Of course, the Buddha says the cure for lethargy and drowsiness is more energy. Simple, huh? So how to rouse energy? So there's two kinds of energy. I would just mention them because it's helpful to be aware of. The first one is willpower. This is what people usually default to, willpower. You know, you feel a bit sleepy, so get back there. I got to get more energy. I've got to do it. And we get very, very forceful and very aggressive with ourselves, you see. But willpower is very limited because, as I think I already mentioned to you, will is an aspect of self. I'm going to get through my sleepiness. Good luck. Whereas if you step back a little bit and investigate energy in the body, maybe you can notice there's a different kind of energy. I call this life energy or life power. The willpower, you can notice it's quite compulsive and it can't be sustained. You know, when I give meditation retreats, and usually the first day or so I keep my eye on the people, and the people I watch most are the ones who sit there like brass Buddha statues, you see, because they're not going to, they can't sustain it. They're going to either take off into outer space or they're going to collapse, run away. And obviously they're behind that, there is usually, they have a very strong desire to attain something. There's a willfulness there. I want to get enlightenment. I want to get concentration or something or other. And that's not a very good attitude. The purpose of the Buddha's teachings is to open to the way things are, not to have our desires fulfilled. So it's a dead end. So they sit there the first day, you know, and then the second day it's... can't be sustained. And the third day they're either gone or they're crumpled up on the floor. But if you observe the nature of the energy level in the body and notice the energy which is more sustainable, life energy, you know, the amount of energy you have to sustain your life, it's the breath coming in, the breath going out, and it's very even, and it's more natural. And maybe you notice that there are certain factors that do kind of increase your energy or deplete your energy. I mean, just the fact of, say, eating food after the meal, you know, the bodily energy is digesting food. It's not there in your brain to increase samadhi, concentration. Simple fact of life, you know. You don't have to be a physiologist to know that. And the Buddha even mentioned in the Pali Canon, one of the causes of sleepiness is sluggishness after the meal. So better to do walking meditation than sitting right after the meal. And it's helpful to tune into our own biorhythms. As I mentioned already, some people are energetic in the morning and exhausted in the evening, and some are vice versa. Yeah. In a monastery in Thailand, because of the environmental conditions there, we used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. Nice and cool in the morning. Mosquitoes are still asleep. And retire earlier in the evening after we've already fed the mosquitoes at 6 o'clock. Then we were exhausted. We had to resupply our blood again. But I'm a morning person. So when I'm in my cave, I get up at 2 o'clock in the morning. At least I get a few hours meditation in before walking down the mountain, you see. But then by 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, retire. And get up at 2 o'clock. But I know one of my monk friends, he's opposite. He hates getting up in the morning. So he gets up at 6 o'clock and stays up till midnight, you see. And if you could tune into your own biorhythms, you're then more in tune with your natural rhythms. And so rather than struggling against them, I mean, he struggled in Thailand because it wasn't his biorhythm to get up at 3 o'clock, you see. That's why he lives in England now. He can set his own alarm clock. But there are various ways to generate energy. I mean, rather than just try and generate energy, I would say it's helpful to try and investigate, you know, the nature of energy in your body. First of all, you know, what causes energy to be depleted? What increases the energy, and try and understand the processes more, so you learn to live more in harmony with it, rather than being, you know, fighting against the natural rhythms of the body. And there are quite a few different, the Buddha gave quite a few different techniques for generating energy. Some of them have to do with just the basic physical aspect of the body, you know, keeping the body well fed, exercised. You know, when I was first in Thailand, my limited understanding of meditation was basically just concentration. So I went to this forest monastery and I just sat. And then I began to fall asleep, sleep. And I got really, really physically, I got weak. And I couldn't keep up the sitting anymore. So I was so weak I couldn't even sit anymore. And then going to the forest monasteries in northeast Thailand, they had a lot of activity there. We had going long alms rounds to collect food for an hour or two every day in the villages, and then we had water hauling, had to haul the water, had to do sweeping, and they had long, big walking meditation paths. So it wasn't about sitting so much. It was about trying to cultivate awareness and concentration through a variety of activities, more normal. And I found it myself that when I was living on my own in a monastery in North Thailand, I would mostly, in the daytime, mostly do walking meditation in the daytime, and then I could sit longer at night as far as energy goes, rousing energy, and just the flexibility of the body. You know, sitting for hours can be not only painful, but can lead to lethargy. You know, in the spiritual powers, it's advised to balance energy with concentration. Too much concentration can lead to kind of lethargy and drowsiness. Your mind is being focused and concentrated, narrowed down, so inclines towards dullness and sleepiness. Energy is opening up, and it can lead to restlessness if it's too much energy without enough focus. So we balance these, trying to balance these two, energy and concentration. You see, it's energy is expansive, concentration is contraction. And each person has their own, you know, their own preferences or their own degree of how much energy they need to be able to keep the body healthy. It's one aspect, well-fed, good enough food. And sometimes we bring in exercises too. You know, I mentioned to people, there was one man in Switzerland, I think it was, he came on a retreat, And then he found that when he was sitting, he was kind of twitching. And I said, what's your job? He said, I write manuals for the chemical companies in Basel. So all day long, he's sitting at a desk or sitting at a computer. And I said, do you get any exercise? He said, oh, no, I just sit there all day. And I said, well, no wonder you're twitching. You know, all this restless energy, nervous energy in your body. And then you come and sit and meditate. And or if you do some exercise, ideally meditative exercise, yoga or tai chi, or even some physical exercise, swimming or jogging, you know, you can channel some of that nervous energy into physical activity and ideally mindful physical activity, and then, you know, it can energize the body and it helps with your meditation. Too much focusing, too much narrowing, and too much contraction is not very balanced. And then the other one is restlessness. Too much energy sometimes. There can be various causes. I mean, maybe something like fear sometimes may become prominent and makes the mind very restless and agitated. So sometimes using physical exercises can help us to get a bit more of a more space around this initial cause of fear, for example. You know, rather than just being taken over by restlessness, channel some of that restless energy into walking meditation or active meditation. And then it can help you to get more space to observe what's the cause of it. You know, the fear again, or whatever is the root cause of it. So there are quite a few different techniques I mention in my book here. And some of them, as I mentioned, some of them we would adapt maybe to Western situations. Like one of the ones used by some of the forest teachers to deal with sleepiness was to sit meditation on the edge of a cliff. Not my recommendation. We only hear the stories of the monks who succeeded. The ones who nodded off over the cliff we never hear about, you see. But I know a few of the monks who did it, and of course they succeeded and wrote a book about it. But sometimes there, you know, basically sometimes the lethargy is basically physical. The one monk in Thailand, he had a lot of sleepiness and dullness, lethargy. He came to the West and they found he had chronic fatigue syndrome. he thought he had a hindrance, but it was a physical ailment. Other times there are mental aspects to it, or mental qualities to it. You know, something like, you know, sometimes maybe there are aspects of our being which my ego doesn't want to see, so put you to sleep. It just clouds your mind and puts you to sleep. So maybe you have to go back to just the basics, increasing your awareness, concentration, more body awareness, maybe approaching this from a different angle. So being more grounded in the body can be helpful. It is about energy. And there's physical energy and mental energy. And these are interrelated as well. So sometimes it has to do with working with the body, sometimes working with more with the mind. So you have to find out, first of all, what is the basis of this lethargy, physical or mental, you can say. And then maybe you have to work at that a bit more. When I was able to do more my own practice. I generally do more walking meditation than sitting. I have a restless temperament too, see? And a restless mind. And I haven't tried the sitting on a cliff yet, but I did think of an alternative. Sit on the edge of your swimming pool. Maybe you wanted to fall in then. but if you do nod off, then you get to just wake, you just fall in the water and get wet and wake up, huh? Sometimes it is kind of habit tendencies we've cultivated. You know, some people, they would escape from reality by just shutting down. They shut down, they don't want to see things. And so their habitual attitude to life is go to sleep, sleep it off. And maybe it has been triggered off by, you know, maybe a trauma, maybe it's just an attitude they develop. So we have to investigate the nature, you know, study these particular hindrances. I mean, studying lethargy and drowsiness, I must admit, is pretty challenging. But I had my own, after about 2 years or a year and a half in Thailand, I had a real problem with sleepiness. I mean, it was so serious, it was more like sit down and I'm unconscious, just like that. I wake up in an hour and where was I? Was I sleepwalking? What was I doing? And I tried everything. I mean, I tried various methods to sit only at times when I was normally awake, after a cup of coffee, after walking meditation, and it just, nothing seemed to work. But I had a chance to go to a meditation monastery and ask the teacher there. And so he very insightfully said, oh, just watch your mindfulness, just watch your sleepiness. Yeah, right. Isn't that the problem? Isn't that the problem? I'm asleep. How can I watch my sleepiness? I'm asleep, you know. But it was in this meditation monastery, so I had nothing else to do for 3 months except look at sleepiness. Nothing else to do. They didn't allow you to do anything else. No talking or reading or anything. Just meditate and watch your sleepiness. Well, that was my issue anyway. So that's what I was doing. After a month, I noticed, actually, it wasn't sleepiness at all. There was, first of all, there was neutral feeling tone. And then, blanked out. Then the next month, I noticed that before the neutral feeling tone, there was a kind of a shutting down. And then neutral feeling tone, and then sleep, then unconsciousness. It was a cause and effect sequence there. And then I realized what I'd been doing. I was in this monastery practicing by myself, and I had some what I would call worrying thoughts. You know, should I go, should I stay, should I go back to university, should I continue my travel? You know, so I looked in the meditation manual, and it said, the cure for worry is equanimity. That's what I need, equanimity. So I'll develop equanimity, and then I fell asleep. But then I realized I wasn't actually developing equanimity, I was developing indifference. Equanimity is a very advanced state of mind. It's being equanimous with everything, even minded. It's not turning off. You have to be totally awake with everything, but still be even minded with it. So I was developing indifference, I mean shutting down, and not giving attention to my worry or any other thoughts, just turn them off. And then there was neutral feeling, because it was like being numb, you know, emotionally numbed out, and then unconsciousness. So I realized I had to undo that. So I stopped practicing indifference, and then all the worry came back. But at least I was awake anyway. And then I had to work with worry, so in a more skillful way. And then the sleepiness went away, this unconscious. When I got down to the, you know, after fighting with it for months and months, got nowhere, finally investigating the cause, when I could relieve the cause, sleepiness went away. Doesn't mean I don't fall asleep, but now when I fall asleep, it's usually because I'm tired, not indifferent. So sometimes it takes a little bit of investigation and, you know, and working with these particular hindrances to be able to, say, uncover the root causes. And if you use it, if you do, and you work with them that way, we get more understanding of how our mind works, the nature of these basic, you know, factors of life, more wisdom, as it were, and we understand the nature of ourself better. I think, as I mentioned at the very beginning, all these hindrances are basically the negative expressions of selfhood. So in a way, they're very valuable because we all know that grasping selfhood is a cause of suffering, right? Grasping selfhood or attaching to it. But it's for most people, it's pretty abstract, isn't it? Yeah, selfhood, yeah, who's that? Where's that? But here we have five very obvious symptoms of selfhood. So it's just like having a red light on your dashboard, see? Selfhood is happening. So if you can recognize that and you can study it and investigate it, you follow it back to the roots of grasping. Behind it all is grasping some aspect of self. You know, either, you know, sensual desire, something in there I need. I feel like I need, myself needs to be sustainable or something. Aversion is something I don't want, keep away from me. It's threatening my sense of self. Lethargy is something, there's no natural energy there. There's no life energy. It's being blocked by something or other, my grasping of something. Restlessness, likewise, and doubt and confusion and uncertainty. You know, I want to know. But actually, most things we'll never know, maybe. I won't know. There is consciousness. There is some degree of consciousness. But whether it's the knowing which satisfies my ego, and then with that knowing, I think I can control it now. Huh? When I know, I'm in control now. And the other way is recognizing that the self doesn't really know, but it's open to the way things are with the flow of life. So when we begin to work with these in a skillful way, gradually we work through these hindrances and the selfhood begins to become lighter and lighter and lighter. The grasping of it, these different aspects of selfhood becomes lighter and lighter and lighter, and before you know it, gee, there's enlightenment around the corner. maybe eventually. Maybe not sooner, maybe later than sooner, but but you begin to see the results. These are hindrances for meditation, but I would say they're also hindrances of life. Huh? Yeah, now you can walk past the all these fancy stores and no sensual desire for any of them. No aversion, no sensual desire for them. So it can also impact upon your life in a skillful way, much more at peace with so-called hindrances or challenges or difficulties. They're just all grist for the mill. Sound good? Well, you just got to practice it now, huh?